Hello, I'm Richard Lee. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we'd like to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. To get 10% off your first purchase, just head to squarespace.com/guardian. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
You know, there's magical photographs of groups of men, miners, whatever, dancing with each other. Partly because there's no women, but surely also because they were fancying each other. Mm. Or if 10% were fancying each other and the others were looking just to have a dance, it's still, you know, the magical thing.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. This week we're looking at all manner of magical things, speaking with Sebastian Barry, who's magically won the Costa Book of the Year Award for the second time, the first novelist ever to win it twice. Not that he seems to have any idea about how he did it.
It's not only that I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm not sure I want to know. And I'm not sure if not knowing actually is more important to the writer than knowing.
Though perhaps it was something to do with the red wine.
I should be able to identify them, shouldn't I, as dreadful sentences, the work of a drunkard. But I can't. It was as if, you know, Thomas was entirely sober and he was intent on telling me about, you know, the high days of his life, his days without end.
The novelist and playwright Sebastian Barry won the Costa Book of the Year for the first time in 2009 with The Secret Scripture. His latest novel, Days Without End, charts the transformations of Thomas McNulty as he fetches up in the United States in the middle of the 19th century and builds a life with handsome John Cole. After fleeing famine-gripped Ireland, they work as cross-dressing dancers, sign up for the army and set up an unconventional family, the novel weaving together moments of shocking brutality and domestic existence. A couple of days before the Costa Award ceremony, with no inkling that a win was just around the corner, Barry joined Sean Kane in the studio and began with a reading from the very beginning of the novel.
The method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. Like decking out our poor lost troopers for marriage rather than death. All their uniforms brushed down with lamp oil into a state never seen when they were alive. Their faces clean shaved as if the embalmer sure didn't like no whiskers showing. No one that knew him could have recognized Trooper Watchhorn because those famous Dundrearys was gone. Anyway, death likes to make a stranger of your face. True enough, their boxes weren't but cheap wood, but that was not the point. You lift one of those boxes and the body makes a big sag in it. Wood cut so thin at the mill, it was more a wafer than a plank. But dead boys don't mind things like that. The point was, we were glad to see them so well turned out, considering.
I wanted to start with a reading because I wanted to talk to you about Tom's voice. Because Tom's voice is possibly the most vibrant I have read in as long as I can remember. It's sort of a strange blend of Americana, but there's also a little bit of Irish in there. And I was just wondering, how did Tom's voice come to you? How did you start writing in Tom's voice?
It's a question of, I mean, I live in good circumstances for a writer in that we live in the mountains in Wicklow, in an old stone house. It was very quiet. Well, you do have the rooks, who are occasionally very noisy, but that's about the height of the ruckus of where we are. So I'm in a position where I can sit very quietly, waiting for the voice of a book. For Thomas, I suppose it took about 9 months. I thought I was doing, you know, that fatal thing for writers actually to be writing, where you're trying to write the first chapter. It was about the Irish famine. You think you're getting along with the book, and slowly, slowly, it comes upon you that this isn't it at all. And finally, you realize, well, I can't write this because Thomas would obviously never speak about these things. It's much too traumatic. So I was left with complete silence, which, as you can imagine, is awkward and embarrassing for a writer. But eventually, one day, one, in my terms, in my life, private life, magical day, he said that first line, the method of laying out a corpse in Missouri sure took the proverbial cake. And I'm not sure I even knew what he was talking about, but I knew it was him. And sitting in behind that line in the most curious way that I can't even properly explain to you, the rest of the book was lying, like a landscape, like a series of lines stretching out. and for the next few months of just sitting with Thomas, as if we had a fire between us and a chair each, and listening to him, and seeing and hearing, as he spoke into my ear, seeing and hearing everything he was saying. You know, they were my, in a sense, my days without end. They were magical days. And you, I've been writing for 40 years, and it's, you know, you feel like it's a greatly privileged and greatly thanked and greatly awarded by that sort of experience with the book. No, I don't drink, and as a rule, I can hear my wife chortling in the background. But for this book, you know, in the evening, I was so excited by it. I mean, almost disgracefully excited by doing it, that I just needed to calm down a bit. So I thought, well, maybe really good red wine will do that. And even then, I'd have had a two or three glasses of wine. I'd go back to my workroom, and magically, there'd be another few sentences there just to do. I know that he'd say, and so I'd write them down. And I should be able to identify them, shouldn't I, as dreadful sentences, the work of a drunkard. But I can't. It was as if, you know, Thomas was entirely sober, and he was intent on telling me about the high days of his life, his days without end.
So the book Days Without End, it follows, it's sort of Thomas looking back on his life and sort of throughout the American Civil War and the American before that, which is very fractured. It's a very lawless land. And then afterwards, it's seemingly even more fractured. And I was just wondering whether, did you have the interest in that sort of period of history before you wrote the book, or did it come with that first line, knowing I'm going to set this in that period of American history?
I did. I mean, I would take the risk of saying that it, rather than Cuchulainn or the exploits of the Fianna, you know, the true mythology in a person of my generation would be the American films. And, you know, the Marx Brothers and Laurel Hardy, Ford's films, and not only Ford's films in respect of this book, but all those possibly atrocious, I don't know, B movies, C movies, Z movies, cowboy movies that we watch. We had a local, when I was a little boy, at the top of the road, there was a cinema, the old Adelphi Cinema, and all the children of the district on certain days, probably a Saturday afternoon, were shoved in, corralled into a little space like errant sheep for one and tuppence, whatever it was. And we were given, you know, these supposedly cheaply bought films to watch. But it inhabited us in a way that I don't think we needed to know about at the time. So that when my grandfather, years ago, my mother's father, with whom I shared a room, said in passing that he'd had a great uncle who fought at the Indian Wars, age 8 or 9, I thought I knew what he was talking about, because I thought that was the landscape of all these films we watched. Up the years afterwards, you know, you begin to think different things about that. Okay, so here's a guy, Thomas McNulty, leaves Sligo, having lost everything behind him in the famine, a native Irish person who in his own way would have had to make an accommodation, or his family anyway, with 300 or 400 years of colonialism, etc., with moments in that history where Cromwell is saying, I wish to erase this lice-like population and bring beautiful English people in, and we'll have a paradise in Ireland. Do you know that? All right. And it's sometimes said the English learned how to deal with native peoples in Ireland and then brought those methods on to America. All those things. So you might expect him to go to America then and be a sort of advocate of this disaster taking place, which in my mind, because the history is written by the victors, isn't it? And in a way, we take American history in good faith and at face. But actually, in my mind, having read for a year for this and having had the experience of writing, it is the most atrocious, one of the most atrocious chapters in human history, but also we can almost see it. It's almost modern. It's 1850s. It's not that long ago. But instead of him going to America and becoming a kind of strange advocate, you know, as people were at the time, advocate of civil rights, actually, strangely enough, but they wouldn't have called it that. He is obliged to become a soldier. He fights in the Indian Wars. And so that he's actually dispossessing a people not unlike his own people. It's that. Now, that can be politically a kind of sobering thought. But as a novelist, of course, it's a disgracefully exciting thought as well, because it sets up this echoing contradiction. I do believe if, you know, you're asking an interest in the period, if it was still there, and that's the other curious thing, like 20 years later, that America was already gone, as Francis Parkman remarks in his book on the Oregon Trail. So even in the 1870s, it's gone. it's covered in cities and factories, and the native peoples have already been entirely and utterly dispossessed. I do still think that a young person might be inclined to go there. It was an excitement to try and, well, I mean, the poor old novelist has to kind of reinvent it, has to recreate it, which is a big task. But having done so, you feel that despite the dangers and the horrors, this is actually a place one would still like to go, because there's a tempering of the personality. I mean, you're saying that Lawless, but it was also in another way, you know, it was a testing ground or a place where little tinctures of possibilities were arising. Do you know, you could live. It's like the little history of cross-dressing in America is very interesting, because in 1863, I think, in San Francisco, there was an ordinance made outlawing cross-dressing. But up to that point, there was this strange and kind of wondrous, it's not a liberality, but it's as if not seeing or not bothering to interpret, or just things were as they were, because, of course, it was a society, especially west of the Missouri or the Mississippi, largely without women.
Mm.
Men were literally thrown together and did occupy not only public spaces that women would normally have occupied, men did, but also domestic spaces. So there was a sort of nascent possibility in America. Of course, that was trounced and destroyed quite quickly. But that kind of thrilled me, that here was, even in the chaos of America, as you say, even in the lawlessness, the very lawlessness was allowing this magical tincture of possibilities.
Yeah.
That was lovely to try and go back and taste those again and see those again.
It's such a wonderful scene early on where Thomas and John Cole go to this little bar, and he's got a sign up asking for clean boys, and that could just mean anything, but it becomes very apparent very quickly that he would like to.
Well, John Cole says, "Well, we fulfill half of that."
You know. Yeah. And so they sort of scrub up a little, and they dress, and immediately there's absolutely no sense of any masculine-driven homophobia or anything like that. All these men that come to see Thomasina and John Cole dressed up in these big gowns, they treat them very gentlemanly, and it's almost with a gratitude that
they
see these two boys.
Well, it's supplying a great want, and it's performative. It's theatre, which was also immensely important to me. I mean, having been in theatre, but also to try and imagine some sort of proto-theatre of the day. They're young boys. They're in America, you know, without social services. If you don't work, you die. You famish, and they come from a famine, or Thomas comes from a famine. But equally, John Cole's father's farm in New England at the bottom has fallen out of that. So he's just an orphan as well. So it's the two of them. I mean, they come into town. They're willing to do anything. They say that we're willing to stick knives in people if we can get away with it. We'll do any work that's going. And here's this work that's going where, you know, there's magical photographs of groups of men, miners, whatever, dancing with each other. Partly because there's no women, but surely also because they were fancying each other. Or if 10% were fancying each other and the others were looking just to have a dance, it's still, you know, the magical thing. So here are these two boys, and they're good, and they're going to look well as girls, and he's going to very carefully hire them out to the miners, and everyone's going to be very well behaved. I don't know, because that was the first day when I was doing the book, and I just was surprised by Thomas. You know, I loved him saying all these things. I loved what he was telling me, and I was sitting there as more receiving the book. I mean, not exactly reading the book, but being given the book, because I thought, you know, there are more things in heaven and earth, Mr. Trump, dare I say, than are dreamt of in, you know, in certain philosophies. And one of the philosophies is received history as we get it. You know, it's much more exciting than they're letting on.
Well, I think a lot of the reviews have touched on this, how this sort of relationship between Thomas and John Cole, almost very domestic, suburban almost romance that they have with each other and their adopted daughter, and how it should feel anachronistic, but it doesn't.
I mean, this is the nature of history, of which I've, you know, my closest friend is a great historian, Roy Foster, and I know the problems that they have. They must have sources. They must have documents. They can't just surmise. you know, history is very, very tiresome when it might have been this, or she might have said that, or he might have said that. But, I mean, that's the whole business of the novelist. The novelist is a very disreputable Jesse James historian, whereas, you know, there's Pat Garrett historians are the proper ones. But, you know, we're not, it's not that we get away with it, but we're trying to get away to Mexico with it. And so we're allowed to imagine these things. And yet, at the same time, as I read through my year, when in my year of reading, I realized that there are the little hints and touches. Also, when I was reading for Hans Christian Andersen, who had a great love affair with a young Danish actor when he was older, all these things were in existence. All these magics were fully taking place. And then you realize, okay, Australopithecus, okay, 10% of Australopithecus, I'm sure, were, you know, same gender attracted, if one can put it that way. So it's always been part of us. It's actually an incredibly important part of us. It's actually a kind of reason, you know, if there was any God or anything, for St. Peter to let us in, you know, that we are fully magical creature. We have also this attribute. We have these attributes, but then we have this attribute. And sometimes it's manifest in people. And isn't it incredible, you know, as in my son, and I, who is gay. And I realized that just because lives are not documented, and, you know, poor Roy Foster is bunched then and trumped. But, you know, obviously these lives were led. I mean, it's absolutely clear and obvious that, especially in the army, I mean, anyone who's being honest about the army or the navy, you know, when you're thrown together, certain things happen. But also in the context of ordinary lives lived, and I thought it was important. And it also surprised me, I have to say, that in this great mayhem of history, they were tending towards this family unit.
Mm.
Like Thomas would love, you know, in his heart, he's much happier thinking of himself as Thomasina and Winona's mother. At the same time, he's quite proud. He'd be quite proud if she thought of him as her father.
Mm.
And obviously, John Cole is the better father. But you know, what could he do about that? But, you know, that because we used to in Ireland when I was young, we used to have this awful body called the Catholic Truth Society. And, you know, they tend to prioritize the family as the proper unit. And that's why they're kind of fuels anti-gay prejudice, the whole idea. But I thought, no. Here's a family unit. Here's incredibly functioning, glittering with purpose, resplendent with success family unit between two men close to my heart, and taking this equally lost girl to themselves and creating something in the fervor of the time that is admirable, integral and true.
Mm.
So to hell with ye, the Catholic Truth Society.
Well, it did feel every single time, sort of in between John Cole and Thomas going off to go on the battlegrounds, that every single time they were at home, you felt like the book could sort of end here. That you could imagine them living out their lives in that little house.
Yes,
I mean it was sort of an unexpected but very welcome look at gender fluidity in a way, because Thomas also wears clothing around the house, the female clothing, and as you said, likes the term mother, but then also has this very male role in periods of the book where he's in these very masculine environments, in these very vicious battles, and it's somehow a marvellous balance of the two.
He's a very good soldier. You know, my grandfather was a soldier. He was a major in the British Army in the Second World War. He was in bomb disposal. In fact, when we were wheeled out to meet your lovely queen in recent times, I was longing to tell her about this grandfather who was defusing bombs in England.
Mm.
You know, a beautiful job for an Irishman, I wanted to say to her, because I didn't. He said something completely different, talked about her Rembrandts. But, you know, he's a good soldier, but the soldiering he has to do is atrocious. It's appalling.
Mm.
This is from a moment in the book where Thomas and his fellow soldiers are engaged in something, for them, maybe slightly uncharacteristic. They're in vengeful mood because some of their own soldiers have been killed by the Sioux, the local Sioux, and they've gone down to a village to exact revenge. This is just a little at the center of this, where Thomas is really describing the moment of attrition, I suppose you'd call it. "Fire, firemen," calls our sergeant, "and we reload like lunatics in fire. Powder, ball, ram, cap, cock, and fire. Powder, ball, ram, cap, cock, and fire. Over and over and over and over, death at his frantic task in the village, gathering souls.
We work in our lather of strange sorrow, but utterly revengeful, fiercely so. Soldiers of intentful termination, of total annihilation. Nothing else will slake our thirst, nothing else will fill our hunger. To this story of our dead comrades we are writing an end on the hot wind of summer. As we fire, we laugh. As we fire, we cry out. As we fire, we weep. Leap away, Hubert, pull the string. Cock an ear, Boethius, back with the horses. Raise up your musket, John Cole, fire and fire again. Blue line of men, look lively, for death is a fickle friend.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
I was wondering about, because this book is full of very intense and very visceral description, and I was wondering, does writing about such violence as depicted in this, both sexual and also physical battle violence, does that almost lend itself to a certain gentleness in the language and a certain lyricism in order to counteract the horror in which you're writing about? Because it didn't matter how bloody the book got, it always remained beautiful, which really, really struck me.
Well, there's a strange responsibility in writing these things that when I did a book about the Irish in the First World War, the Irish soldiers in the First World War, I felt I wanted to be very clear about the battles so that if people still wanted to call them traitors to Ireland or fools or whatever people say about them, at least you would know what they'd gone through and then you could make a decision. Because it's very difficult to have an opinion about something if you haven't experienced it. And in a book, you can vicariously experience it. So I was intent in that book on doing that. And it was similar in this, that the kind of the dominant tone, the dominant part of Thomas is not judgmental. He's not a political person. He's a survivalist, in a way. And he wants to tell you clearly what he got through, what he survived. Because in a way, that's his own sense of personal victory, that they were thrown into these terrifying malaise, he and John, and came through the other side. There's no point in prettying it up either. And I did feel that reading a lot of the history, especially of the time, do you know, the troops would go out and find an Indian village and everyone would be killed in the village, and then they'd go back into the town as heroes and they'd call it a battle. Now, many, many, many of these so-called battle sites have been renamed as massacre sites. And I thought it was important, at least for me, for my own sense of, you know, the temporary honesty you have when you're writing a book, to get a hold of that. I did have some rules for this book, though. One of them was no poetry, no set scenes, and essentially no writing, just to let him speak. So much so that when I finished it, when I was delivering it to Angus Cargill at Faber, my wonderful editor, I thought this actually could be a sort of blank book. There might be nothing here, because in other books, you know, people have talked about those things. So I just wanted to make a new start, because when you get to 60, you feel strongly the need to make a new start, you know, either to throw yourself off a cliff or make a new start. So I plumped for the second thing. And I was very surprised that, you know, then people have started to talk about the very things that I kept out, set pieces, battle scenes, thought I wasn't doing. And it makes me wonder, well, maybe it's actually good to have those rules, because then if it does happen, it's completely natural. In a way, I can't absolutely answer your question, because it's not only that I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm not sure I want to know. And I'm not sure if not knowing actually is more important to the writer than knowing. You know, I was going into the battles with Thomas and hoping to survive them equally as a writer. You know, so I would also confess, though, and maybe it is disgraceful, it's immensely invigorating writing even about terrors like that. You're so mobilized as a human being, as if you were the soldier beside him, to survive the actual thing. And you're so intent on being true to it that you're in a state that you're not hopefully usually in, of high alert as a writer in the battle scenes. So I will say a good word for them. I recommend them. I asked by it years ago in Canada. I was talking to her, a wonderful person, and I had that just finished the First World War book. And she said, apropos of something else, she said, of course, battle scenes. Anyone can do them. They're too easy. I don't try my hand at that sort of thing. I must say, I don't have a very high opinion of people who do. And I was like, oh, yes, of course. Yes. But, you know, I'm a bit addicted to them now.
Well, I suppose in conflict, there's the potential to explore some extremes of human behaviour and human nature that must be quite appealing as a writer, even if it's something quite horrific.
And I think the things we've lost as beings, you know, supposedly civilised or fixed in our chairs, you know, our legion, that whole attentiveness, alertness that you would have hunting, for instance. I mean, people still go hunting, but the sheer necessity to bring back food. And that is in this book in the sense that when the army is out west, they have to find their own food. Mm. I mean, there's nothing coming up in a wagon for them, or usually. Or they might drive a herd of cows up occasionally, but sometimes they've got to go out and get their food, and that in this case would be a buffalo or a deer. It was very interesting reading about that, you know, people got very tired of deer meat. They didn't really care for it, and they weren't too keen on buffalo either. Bears they liked, poor bears. I mean, imagine that. But their favourite thing of all was dog meat, if you can imagine.
Really?
That. Yes. So, anyway, just throw that in. That's incredibly interesting.
That's a good fact. I mean, it felt like Thomas was recounting his story to you as you wrote it down. How did you know when you'd come to the end?
Very good question. I didn't actually. I got to the point, the ending, I mean, endings are curious things, aren't they? Endings almost need a mythical, or a committee. You should submit a number of endings to the committee of closest friends, and they'll tell you which one it should be. For instance, Dickens used to send them to John Forster.
Really?
Should Little Dorrit die? Should Pip get away with it? Or whatever. And Forster would very clearly write back to him and tell him what it should be, and then Dickens would make his own decisions, I presume. But endings are very difficult. And sometimes we can't even really talk about it, propose a book, because I don't want to spoil anyone's reading of it. But let us say that for a long time, I had a slightly different ending in mind, or I thought I did. And indeed, the whole recounting of the book was positioned from that, because that's what you need. You know, you need a moon to be aiming at if you're going to the moon. And the moon in a book is the ending. So you think you're on a trajectory towards that particular moon. It was not too late in the day, but certainly afternoon in the day of writing the book, let's say, where I realized that I was mistaken. And since I reached that point quite late, it was an immensely rewarding decision because, for instance, it allowed Major Neil to do something slightly redemptive. It led to a kind of earned lightness, I thought. I mean, you may disagree at the end. And it's a sort of ending I never allow myself to write, but then it's a sort of book I never allow myself to write. And as something happens to Thomas at the end, be as imprecise as that, something happened to me. I mean, I felt a sense of freedom as a human being. Because, you know, writing a book is a great adventure that you go on without leaving your workroom. And there's sort of manumission, you know, where some of the chains you've loaded yourself with are taken off and the lock of the chain is put on the bridge across the Thames, you know, as a token of love or whatever. But it seemed right somehow. But it was no longer the head working. I'm a bit suspicious of the human brain. We don't know a lot about it, but, you know, when you read for a year, all that information is going into a certain part of your brain, but it's definitely not the part of your brain you write out of. So in a way, you have to forget all that and let the few little things seep through whatever partition of the brain that might be and whatever it's composed of into this other part of your brain that you write out of. And the strangeness of it, I can't quite describe to you properly. And the decision-making is not the decision-making of an adult. You know, that's the question of the ending becomes more an innate communion with more the pleasures of childhood, of looking forward, of the child on which something is suddenly dawning, you know, and he comes to the dinner table and tells the adults this incredible thing he's discovered new and fresh in the world that they've known all their lives. You know, that sort of feeling of privileged innocence, you might say, or experienced innocence.
The Days Without End, it's nominated for the Costa. It's already won the Costa Novel of the Year, but it is also up for Costa Book of the Year, which you'll find out next week. What's that like? Because last time you had this in 2008 and you won, which was must have been remarkable, but it must be
it
nice to go up again.
There's a beautiful picture, actually, I think it was in the Daily Mail, of all places, of my wife, Ali, giving me a kiss, giving me a hug after that. It was one of my favourite photographs, because the two of us look as, you know, as free as birds. It's a great moment of freedom. At the same time, I will say, I mean, I've said a number of times, you know, whenever you have the fortune, and it is really luck to win something, I always say, well, you only gave it to me because you thought I was Sebastian Faulks, and now you've realised your error, but it's too late. And I'm really happy you made the error. And last night, I met Sebastian Faulks for the first time. This is displacement answer. Isn't it? And I told him that, and he said, oh, well, next time I win something, I'm going to say you thought I was Sebastian. So, you know, it is a joyful... I don't know what people say, other people say about it, but I've always felt that, you know, with the Booker or the Costa or James Tate, it's like the circus has stopped at the bottom of your garden. And said, come on, hop on. And you go off with the strong man and the bearded lady and you're just part of the circus for a while. Inevitably, you know, you get to some wintry Irish town and they let you out. And they say, well, unfortunately, there's no bus from here, so you'll have to walk home. I'm sure that's how it ends. But it's very nice to run away with the circus for a while. And that's what I think these are. I mean, they're beautifully arranged circuses. And I must say, even as a reader, all the books on the Costa shortlist, I mean, before we got to this stage, were very fine books. Mm. And we were fortunate. And I think, you know, in these hard times, these difficult times, these illiberal times, it's a rather thrilling fact that there's beautiful books being made. It's a recompense to me anyway, as a reader, and I'm sure to many, many others.
4 days later, the chair of the judges, historian Kate Williams, stood up alongside Costa's Dominic Poole to crown Sebastian Barry the winner of the Costa Book of the Year Award.
We live in uncertain times, times that historians will look back on, discuss endlessly, dissect, and in such times, we turn to reading. 1984 is now newly again at the top of the bestseller lists, strikingly relevant in a time when alternative facts are entering the lexicon and George Orwell's satire of the Ministry of Truth seems ever more important. For books are important because they tell us the deepest truths about who we are and the perils we face, both from outside and within ourselves. All five of the shortlisted books are, as you've seen, so very different in subject matter, but they explore to dazzling and superb effect the great questions that we're currently asking ourselves. What is power? What is it within us that craves dominion over others? And can we gain power but retain our humanity, be in the words of Shakespeare, those that have the power to hurt and will do none? In our new world, it's of the utmost importance that we remind ourselves and our children that technology is a wonderful thing, but it doesn't always encourage the reflection, the self-exploration that a book and books like these can bring. Social media, an excellent way of spreading the word. But there can be fake news, bubbles of facts, the immediacy of the click, the glow of the screen, and books are different. They give us a long journey, whether present, past or future, into what it really is to be human. And in the days ahead of us, our shared humanity is, I think, the most important thing to remember. So you see us, ladies and gentlemen, fresh from exciting debate, although we did it in inflatable costumes this year with inflatable rods, a bit like it's a knockout. That was our vision for freshening up the judges at meeting this year. But after a few hours of inflatable bloodshed, we, all of our judges, reached our conclusion. And, well, mind you, maybe we had the easy job compared to the superb category judges who reduced a list of hundreds of books submitted this year. I think they all must have very weary postmen, down just to five. All five of our brilliant shortlisted books embody fantastic storytelling, each one showing us in its different way about the truths of the human heart in all its complex and intricate ways. But of course, there can be only one winner.
So, the Costa Book of the Year 2016 winner is... Days Without End by Sebastian Barry.
We knew
nearly had the first instance of a posthumous winner. I got such a fright. It's often said that about the short list of prizes that any of them could have won, and I think the judges would agree that on this occasion any of these amazing, amazing books could have won, leaving aside my own. I do want to thank the judges. You've made me crazy happy from the top of my head to my toes in a way that is a little bit improper at 61.
Congratulations to Sebastian Barry, crazy happy and on the verge of something improper. Days Without End is published by Faber. Next week, we're joined by the novelist Michael Chabon, who'll be discussing the novel that won him the Pulitzer Prize back in 2001, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But for me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, thanks for listening. Bye-bye. I will always call this my home, my home sweet home. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.